everyone, and welcome to the first episode of the Making Society podcast, a podcast dedicated to makers who want to become entrepreneurs. The goal of this Making Society podcast is to help you create a hardware startup, launch your own hardware business by knowing more about prototyping, manufacturing, distributing, how to launch a product, how to market your product, how to launch a crowdfunding campaign. So everything related to hardware business. For this first episode, I'm really, really happy to welcome Ben Einstein, who is the managing director and co-founder of Bolt. Bolt is a hardware incubator based in Boston. And in this first episode, he will tell us about prototyping, will share advice about manufacturing, give his view about crowdfunding, and we finally talk about the open source products and when is a good time to become open. So welcome and enjoy. This first episode has been recorded at Tech Shop San Francisco, so don't be surprised if you hear some noise in the background. I'll let you guess which kind of machines are working in the back. So my first question for you is, what kind of mindset do you have to have? You know, when you're a maker, you love to make stuff. But what's the difference with being actually an hardware entrepreneur? How would you define that?
Yeah, so it's actually really simple, or really similar to being an entrepreneur of any kind. Even though you're building something physical, the dynamics of building the business are actually very, very identical to building a software company or a grocery store company or whatever. And so it's really important, in my opinion, to focus a lot on the business side of actually how you do that. And it's a really hard transition for some of the makers to make, because the focus on technology, on solving the problem, is really important. And it's really important, in my opinion, to focus on the business and how the market is going to grow and how you actually develop a solution that makes sense for that market, rather than falling in love with a piece of technology, which is what often people do. Now you can do both, but you have to be really careful that the market is a big part of how you think. And so I think that's where we're going to see the most activity over the next decade or so, is in companies trying to figure out, okay, there's all these makers making all these amazing pieces of technology. How do you turn that into an interesting and a profitable business that can support getting that piece of technology into the hands of a whole bunch of people, or making a lot of money, or supporting a big staff, or whatever the goal is of the people that are making it.
So what would you say are the big challenges that you encounter when you want to go from an idea, a prototype that you have, to actually the market? What are the big hardware challenges nowadays?
Sure, yeah, there are a couple. The first is learning that the prototype that you've built usually is not the prototype that you need. And that's a tough thing to learn, because it seems like you've done so much work and you've made this really great thing that you can show to people. But until you have something that is ready to be distributed and manufactured and sold, it's hard to actually use that prototype. So a lot of the companies and individuals that we talk to have what we call a proof of concept prototype, which is a prototype that's really helpful in demonstrating that something is possible, but it's not good enough to demonstrate how to sell and distribute and manufacture something. And that jump can sometimes be very long. So a common example is, we see a lot of companies that come to us with a prototype of something that has an Arduino in it, and they say, we've made this great prototype, it works, look what we can do, now we want to make 10,000 of them. And they don't realize that an Arduino is not something that you can use in production, at least not yet. It's too expensive and too specific, or too general for what you want to do. And you have to typically start from scratch. You have to build a new PCB board that has different kinds of components on it, and development kits, and all kinds of stuff. So that's one thing, is sort of developing a really good prototype. Then something called design for manufacturability is really important. So understanding the dynamics of actually how you're going to make something at scale. typically actually affects the design pretty significantly. So, as an example, often products are made, or plastic products are made with a process called injection molding. And injection molding has different design constraints than something like using a MakerBot. And so you have to understand how those design constraints are going to change the model that you're building and the prototype that you're building. And that's a really, you know, sometimes those changes can be really significant. Like, oh man, we had this specific screen that we could fit, but now that there's a draft angle for the injection mold tool, we can't fit that screen anymore.
Are there other places to know about these specifications related to injection molding or materials? How do you know that if you're not a professional, right?
The real answer is you have to learn. And it's really hard. It takes a long time, which is why hiring people that know what they're doing or working with people that know what they're doing when it comes to manufacturing is really helpful. It's part of the reason that Bolt exists, is to provide that knowledge to companies. There are little tools all over the internet, totally fractured all over the place, that you can use to do things. So with an example like injection molding, there's a fantastic resource that's available from a company called Protomold, which is essentially a quoting system that allows you to upload a SolidWorks file, it's actually a solids file, but it comes from a CAD file, and it'll tell you, oh, you know, this part can't be molded for this reason, and if you change this, and this, then you can mold it, and this is how much it costs, and that's a really valuable tool to use, even if you don't buy, injection molded parts from them. But for every different kind of technology, there's a different resource or no resource at all, and it's hard to really pick that up. I mean, I've manufactured a lot of stuff, and I still don't really know. So I still rely on people that have done far more things than I have.
So can you tell us more maybe about this prototyping phase? It's still useful, right, to prototype using, 3D printing and Arduino. You have to do that, right, to do this first step of using products that are not scalable, but at least is there, you have this prototype. So what's the next step? Let's say you have this cool prototype, you show it at Maker Faire, it's working with Arduino, and you can print some pieces. You can do it at home, but how do you do the next prototype?
Sure. That's a really important thing. And there are different kinds of prototypes that you have to build for different things. So there's often an electrical prototype that demonstrates that the circuit works and the firmware works and all that stuff. There's often a design prototype, which showcases what the case will look like or what materials you're finishing and how you're finishing them. There's sometimes a mechanical prototype that'll have different mechanics that sort of demonstrate that. I think one of the mistakes that a lot of makers and early entrepreneurs make when they're building hardware is they try to build one prototype that does all of that. And that is extremely hard to do. You have to do it eventually, but usually you can do it all the way at the end. So you can build a circuit board piece. You can say, oh, man, I really want to see how this handle is going to fit. You can build a bunch of different handles and get the right one and then be like, okay, now I got the handle done. And then you can say, okay, I have this mechanical system. I can build that separately, and then you got to put it all together. And that's I found that to be really helpful in saving time. Sometimes saving money, but not always.
So is this where Bolt, is it at this phase and Bolt can be very useful? At which phase do you take startups and do you help them to go to the next level? What's the right time to go to you?
Yeah, I mean, we've talked to companies in an amazingly large range from, one person with a napkin sketch and not really any clue what the plan is, but some really interesting stuff going on, all the way up through, people that have raised millions of dollars and even made stuff already, have actually, mass-produced stuff. And they find relvency in all across that spectrum, which actually is surprising to me. I didn't expect that to happen. I thought it would be much more on the guy with a piece of paper or a napkin sketch of an idea. And so we absolutely, a big part of what we do is help with the prototyping stage. But it's a little different than a typical prototyping sort of assistance, which, much like Tech Shop, is like, here's tools, have fun. And we say, here's really nice tools that are designed to do some things that are similar, but some things that are a little sort of like the next level up from Tech Shop. And we're going to help you actually use them. And we're going to show you, this is how you have to think about, making this kind of part, because you can't mold it the way you want to make it or whatever. And that knowledge of thinking about what we call design for manufacturability and design for assembly early on in the process actually makes, in my opinion, a really big difference to how fast you can get to production.
So what kind of profiles are in the team, and what kind of profiles do you look like? What's the typical entrepreneur that goes to you?
Yeah, so we're just about to do our first class, so we don't actually know what the typical profile is, but it's getting close to being able to say that. I think the application closes tomorrow at midnight. And so we typically look at company or at teams of people that are typically between 2 and 5 people. Mm-hmm. We do talk to companies that have one person, but it's really hard to build a company with one person, especially in hardware. And so it's really good to see, if not multiple co-founders, maybe a founder and a couple of people that work with them.
I'm interested about this number thing, because I think many of us are just individuals having cool ideas and, you know, playing, and we still think that, hey, like, why not do my own little business? Not necessarily big thing, but something that works, that, you know, get some money enough to live from your passion.
Yeah.
So what's the reason, the main reason why it's really hard to build a hardware business on your own? You know, at the difference of, I don't know, opening a blog or something.
Sure. So one of the things that's important to understand here is that there are features, there are products, and there are businesses. And those have very different operating constraints. There are a lot of products that are built that are just features. They have some really interesting thing that they do, but it's very specific. And then sometimes you have a product, which is a self-contained thing, but there may not be a business behind it. It's what we call a one-hit wonder. It's one product, and I don't really know how you would have multiple of them or different versions and lots of people. And then there's a business, which is what I'm the most interested in, which is having usually a product line, so, you know, multiple products that are based on some core idea or problem or market. And it can support lots of people, and it can support, you know, getting these products into the hands of millions of people. It typically lives for many years, which I think is another good thing. And those are the things that I'm most interested in, but it tends to be that the reason that single entrepreneurs have trouble building businesses is because it's really, really hard. And it's amazingly valuable to have someone to talk to when something goes wrong. And you're like, oh man, I picked this wrong capacitor, I built 10 boards and they don't work. Man, I need a drink right now. Like, come hang out with me. And like, there's a nice dynamic you can have with someone that works for you as staff, but it's not the same as someone who's like there with you, like shares your pain and success. And having that element is, in my opinion, like critical to being an entrepreneur. And it's actually something that I find sometimes difficult. Like, it's in any entrepreneur's nature to like want to control things and like feel like it's theirs and want to feel championing and like, this is, you know, this is my baby. And in a way, when you have a co-founder, you're giving pieces of that away. But if you have the right person that you're working with, it is the best. It's like a marriage. It's like the best feeling. It's like, man, I'm with this person and they're really helping me. And I think that's really important.
I heard some good stories too of people that go to, I don't know, hacker spaces or spaces to actually have this kind of exchange, you know, talking, discussions to learn, and you get help from other members from your community, but are not actually part of your business.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's not as intense. Yeah, it's not the same.
And like the business elements are, you know, it's funny because it sounds easy. It sounds like, oh, I have this great product. Like, let's just put a business around it to sell it. But it doesn't quite work like that. A business is a very different kind of entity than a product. And understanding that difference, I think, is hard. And I think really important for makers to understand. And if they want to build a business, there are some dynamics around how to do that that are hard to learn sometimes. And it's totally okay to not build a business. Like, you can build one product or one little feature on something and have a great time doing it and learn a bunch and be totally fulfilled. And if that's your mission, then that's wonderful. But I'm most interested in building businesses. And I think that people that that I tend to really respect and love feel similarly. They want to, like, affect the world in a big way. And I think that a business is, in many ways, a really good way to do that.
So let's talk a little bit about manufacturing and see how you go from this prototyping that we were talking about to the actual production of the product itself. Do you recommend sometimes to go from like small batches or start with a limited edition and test it out and then go for bigger production? Or what's the normal, what's the right path, or what's the best advice you can give for someone wanting to manufacture?
Sure, yeah. So the answer is absolutely. Starting with small batches is always the way to go. The The reason for that is different than what you probably think. Often, people cite the reason as it's easier to build things at small scale than it is at large scale. And that's true, but actually the real reason of why, in my opinion, again, why you should start with small batches is to see if you have a market. And a lot of times you can say, oh man, this thing is great. There's this, 18 to 24-year-olds in California are going to love this thing, and mm-hmm. they're going to sell a million of them, and it's going to be great, so let's go make a million of them. That idea is often wrong, and you don't know why, and you have to figure that out. And so by incrementally making small batches of, you do a couple thousand, 10,000, whatever, units of something, you are able to figure out kind of what works, what doesn't work, how to make changes. Mm-hmm. And while it costs you more money, you wind up spending more money to do those production runs because you have to make new tooling each time, often. Not always, but often. Mm-hmm. It is usually a better thing for the business. If you want to build a product and you just want to, you want to do a run of 500 or something and sell them on Kickstarter or sell them somewhere else, that's totally cool. Mm-hmm. That's still a small run, but it's a different way of thinking about how you actually use that. Typically, when you do a first production run, you use any money that you may or may not make. Oftentimes, you don't make any money, but mm-hmm. that you may or may not make to build tooling for the next production run and so on and so on. And at some point, you get good enough at it that you can be efficient. Mm-hmm. When you manufacture something for the first time, it's nearly impossible to do it right because it's really hard. And it's not rocket science.
What are the common mistakes? Why everyone say hardware is hard. What concretely makes it... Why is there so many mistakes with the manufacturing part? Where are the big problems?
Sure. I mean, at a high level, it all comes from the fact that moving bits around is really easy and moving electrons mm-hmm. around is really hard. Mm-hmm. Moving atoms around is really hard. That is a thing that has drastic consequences because there's friction every time you go to do something different. So there are a couple things. It's very capital intensive. Mm-hmm. It's way cheaper than it used to be. Orders of magnitude cheaper than it used to be. But it's still way, way more expensive than, deploying a Rails app on Heroku, mm-hmm. Which literally costs you zero. It's costs you your time.
Yeah.
There's tooling costs, there's logistics costs, there's component costs, there's often you need consultants and people to help you, there's, shipping is expensive, packaging and returns. There's all these things that kind of affect the costs, which are pretty important.
Mm-hmm.
Distribution is a big thing that I think a lot of people don't think about. They think, I'm just going to make 5,000 of these and get somebody to buy them, and we'll worry about that later, and that's usually, you worry about that all the time. It's mm-hmm. what winds up happening.
Yeah, I heard some, crazy stories of people doing their Kickstarter or crowdfunding and that end up being completely invaded by boxes in their living room, and that became just a nightmare, and they almost really regretted it. They didn't know, they didn't anticipate this distribution part. So what should you do?
it's a funny thing that actually I think happens to almost every hardware person I know, which is actually kind of funny. I've done this for products that I've worked on where you say, okay, we're gonna make 1,000 of these things, and we're gonna have everything made wherever we need to have it made. It's gonna ship it to our house or office or whatever, and we're gonna get some beer and we're gonna assemble them together. And you make five of them, before you do the production run, and you're like, oh man, okay, it takes me 12 minutes to make these. 12 minutes times 1,000, I can do that in a week. Mm-hmm. And you're fine. And something about the way the human brain works doesn't understand that you're getting yourself way, way deeper than you think. And these boxes, an 18-wheeler shows up with plastic pieces, and you're like, oh my God, I have to assemble this 1,000 times. 1,000 is this number that seems small to a lot of people. It's $1,000 or 1,000 units or something is small. 1,000 operations to assemble, 1,000 screwing 1,000 screws in, mm-hmm. It is amazingly painful. And I think we all have to learn that. You have to learn it the hard way, because I can't even though I've done it 5 times, I've made that mistake, I still don't really get it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just one example. You often bite off more than you can chew when it comes mm-hmm. to this kind of stuff.
So do you know of resources or companies that do it for you? Or what are there simple solutions that can be used by, individuals, small entrepreneurs?
Sure, yeah. So like most problems in the world, they're best solved by great people.
Mm-hmm.
And so the best way you can deal with the manufacturing problem is to involve people that have done it before. And you can find them in a variety of ways. You can do what I think a lot of people do, which is buy a plane ticket to Shenzhen and walk around, which I don't recommend at all. But a lot of people do that. It's very hard to know what's good and what's bad. Shenzhen is an extremely overwhelming place. And for a first-time hardware entrepreneur, you don't know what's good. You don't know what to look for. You don't know how to talk to the right people. And you're flying blind. Sometimes it can work out okay, but more often than not, it ends in utter disaster. You can sometimes find people at other companies that can help you as sort of like an advisor, which is sometimes the best way. You can get, sometimes you find people, oh man, this was a great guy at Logitech, and he knows all the manufacturing stuff really well, and he's going to have coffee with me once a month, and he's going to help me through this stuff. Mm-hmm. And that can be helpful, but it's sometimes not enough.
So this kind of person can become an advisor in exchange of some equity shares or something like that. That's the usual model.
I mean, it happens. I don't think it's the best way to do it, but it's an option. I think the best way, is also the most expensive way, which is to hire a firm that does this professionally. And there are a couple of them. The only one I can highly recommend is Dragon Innovation. With full disclosure, I'm biased. Scott Miller, who runs Dragon, is one of my business partners. But
I keep hearing about those guys, Dragon Innovation.
They're a very impressive group of people. Mm-hmm. And they have manufactured tens of millions of units for many venture-backed hardware startup companies and many Kickstarter projects. And they add a huge amount of reliability and experience to being able to build stuff.
So you don't actually need to be a big company to go see them. That's more for
So they typically work on a retainer basis, and it's scaled depending on the the size of the company and how many units they want to make and the complexity and all that stuff. So
what's a retainer basis?
So it's sort of like it's a way like a law firm or a lawyer typically works, where you typically pay some amount of money, mm-hmm. and then that person is available to you until you use that money up, and then you pay it again and available to you again. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of a surefire way to make sure that they don't get screwed by waiting for you to pay for them. Mm-hmm. So you sort of pay. It's like prepaying kind mm-hmm. of. That's a good way to explain it. I don't know.
I think it's clear. So when should you do a crowdfunding? It's a big deal now. Everyone is launching its crowdfunding campaign. It seems like the magical way of getting money. Do you think it's very useful for hardware startups? And when is a good time?
Sure. So crowdfunding is a double-edged sword. It mm-hmm. can be used, when used correctly, it can be used incredibly powerfully. It is extremely rarely used correctly, in my opinion. Crowdfunding really serves to do two things that are typically really hard to do. The first is money, mm-hmm. Which is hard, but actually not the hardest. The second thing, which I actually think is much more valuable that Kickstarter and other crowdfunding platforms do, is they provide you with a market guidance and a good bit of market research data that's hard to get any other way. Because people are not just filling out a survey or talking about what they think and what they like. They're actually paying money for something that doesn't exist. And that's a really valuable thing. Mm-hmm. The problem is it sets a set of dynamics for the company that are set in stone because they're public. And it's an unfortunate casualty that many companies don't make it on time. In fact, 92% of Kickstarter companies don't ship their products on time, mm-hmm. which is a very high number. If 92% of consumer electronics companies didn't ship their products on time, there would be a lot of complaints from a lot of people.
Yeah, and it's not really 2 days late, right? It's a few months, right?
Years sometimes. Yeah. Or, many yeah. months sometimes. And then there's a big percentage of companies, I don't actually remember the number, I think it's 28% or something of Kickstarter projects that never ship. So people pay money, and the backers never
receive. That's a big number.
It's a big number.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's a bad thing for everybody. It's a bad thing for the entrepreneur, it's a bad thing for the consumer, and it's a bad thing for the crowdfunding platform. Mm-hmm. And so there are a series of efforts to try to mitigate that. A lot of times it has to do with the fact that because they don't know how to manufacture a product and distribute a product, they are learning a lot during that process, and the deadlines that they set for themselves or the costs that they set themselves turn out not to be true. And that we can talk about that for hours, mm-hmm. about why that happens, but it's pretty common. And I did it. I think it happens with any first-time hardware entrepreneur. You have to learn, you know, what a good bill of materials looks like, and expectations of how long it takes to cut tooling, and understanding of the amazing amount of time it takes a boat to go from Shenzhen to Long Beach, California. And understanding those dynamics is, I think, pretty important to do a really good crowdfunding campaign. But you can't do that unless you know what those things are for sure. And you usually don't know that until either you hire somebody that knows what they're doing or you've done it before.
So at Bolt, that's you're also helping like companies launching crowdfunding campaigns, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Where appropriate, which crowdfunding has a very specific kind of product that works well for crowdfunding. You know, if Apple wanted to build an iPhone, they wouldn't go to Kickstarter for a whole bunch of reasons. But one of them is that it doesn't really work in that way for companies like that. So there are certain kinds of products, usually mass market products that are sort of at a specific demographic for a specific kind of person. And those products do very well on Kickstarter. It's also extremely marketing oriented. So it's no coincidence that the companies with connections to bloggers and journalists and the companies that have really good videos are the ones that wind up raising a lot of money. And that's true. Honestly, that's true in life. But it's something that I think some Kickstarter, sorry, what are they called? Collaborator? The people that do the projects, they have a name.
Kickstarter. Big, no.
No, backers are the people, the other people.
The project leaders.
Yeah, project leaders. They have a name, I think. But Kickstarter project leaders, that doesn't sound right. But it's
very marketing oriented that they have to think about
right.
PR.
Sorry, yeah. So so they often think, like, oh man, I have this great idea for a product. Let me build a prototype, put it on Kickstarter, and millions of people will come give me money. And that's unfortunately not true. It would be cool if it was, but it doesn't work that way.
You still need context.
Yeah, you have to aggressively pursue the blogs and get people to write about it and talk about it and say good things and make updates and all kinds of stuff.
So one question that I got from many open hardware entrepreneurs wanting to launch a crowdfunding campaign was that, hey, what should I do? Like, should I market my campaign? Should I launch a campaign for the community, open hardware community that would be interested to develop more around my product and, you know, like, who would love to know about my product? Or should I go more mainstream and try to reach you know, non-engineers, non-open hardware activists, non-like people that just want to use my product. So what are your views about this open hardware startup world? Like, do you think like it makes sense to emphasize the fact that you're open source? Or like, I don't know, what are you, is it something that is adding to your business? What are the benefits of it, or what are the dangers, let's say?
The answer to that is that it depends. Like answers to most things. The critical advantage is in community, and that open hardware is a, or you know, it's not even open hardware. It's things that are oriented like open hardware that are all connected to each other. Is a very strong community, and so you can usually tap into it if you, you know, market and distribute and sell and whatever your product with that little logo on it and with the constraints that come with doing that. The problem is they, you know, unfortunately, the average consumer, not only do they not care about what open hardware means, they don't know what it even is. And that's true with software, too. The average person doesn't know what open source software is, even though you and I and everybody else know it very well. And I don't think that that's a bad thing. That's just, it's not important to them, and that's okay. My drive in life is to build great products, and whether that great product is open source or not, or distributed in this way or that, or manufactured in this way or that, I don't care. I care about building something great. And defining what great is really hard. You don't really know how to do that. You know when you see it, but you don't really know how to like say why. So
what's something that makes a product good too is also, as you say, it's community, right? And the open hardware world is really good at building communities.
If a product is built around community, then absolutely it's important to community. But many products are not, and they can be great products too. So it depends on what you're building. You know, if you take, you know, if you, I don't know, if you take a Nest, that Nest is a great product. It is built very well. It's the finishes are fantastic. The user experience is good. The iPhone app is good. You know, all the pieces that make a great product are very solid, mm-hmm. are very good. And community is not at all a part of that, and that's okay. It's still a good product. So I think it's misguided to say that a product has to have a strong community in order to be good. It can, and mm-hmm. a strong community can make products even better. But you can have a good product without a strong community. And so open hardware doesn't need to build great products. That's fine. It needs to build the products that a community really wants to support and adopt. I hope open hardware becomes a bigger thing. But in order for that to happen, I believe that a company needs to be successful in a fairly large scale, in a multi-hundred million dollar scale.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not happening yet.
Yeah, we were talking about it just before, like the Adafruit model or SparkFun are very successful companies, mm-hmm. or even 3D robotics. Those are good examples of already existing big success of open hardware companies, right?
Yeah, so these kinds of big companies, SparkFun is the biggest, I think actually by a lot, although I don't actually know, they are in the at least $100 million range.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great sign. So they do work in that way. The difference is they're not selling to consumers, and I think that's a really important thing. Whereas there are a lot of people that would go to Red Hat and buy Linux and mm-hmm. Use Linux and get Linux support, that would come from surprising places. I don't know how many people that don't know how to solder are buying stuff from SparkFun or Adafruit, mm-hmm. and that's not at all a bad thing. It's just I think that in order for open hardware to become really adopted by the world and really understood by a lot of people, it has to have that kind of impact. It has to be able to be sold to, a dad and his kid trying to make something mm-hmm. in a way that's really, really open. Kind of like MakerBot, which is why I really like the MakerBot story,
mm-hmm.
because they have an open source piece of hardware that was bought by a lot of people that are in that sort of consumer way instead of that maker way. It's sort of bridging the gap between these two separate communities,
mm-hmm.
Which I think is a really important thing. There's been obviously complications with that, but I think that was a really good example of what I think is a really mm-hmm. big company, a really interesting open source consumer-oriented mm-hmm. product.
Do you, maybe it's, I don't know, but do you think they became more closed? What was the main reason? Why did they do that?
Sure, yeah. It has to do with a couple things, I'm guessing. And again, disclosure, I'm reasonably good friends with Breed. So I think that there are some elements of building a big company that require pieces of it to be kept from the public domain. And that's not always true. There are definitely some companies that become really successful by, SparkFun's a great example. They take mm-hmm. everything is in the public domain, and that's a very wonderful model. With consumer products, that doesn't work because you have things like competition, which can sometimes be outrun with speed, like in SparkFun's case. But with developing a consumer product mm-hmm. like the MakerBot, you can't actually do that because you have a fixed amount of shelf life, what we call an EOL, end of life of a product. And that dynamic of having a product on the shelf for 2 years or 3 years or whatever it may be is makes the development process really important in terms of secrecy and protecting things carefully. MakerBot is still an amazingly open company compared to the average consumer products company, which I think is not talked about mm-hmm. as much as it is. But they had raised some private capital from some very good people, and they had spent a lot of that capital, millions of dollars, on developing some intellectual property that is really valuable.
Mm-hmm.
And that piece of value they decided to not put in the public domain. And there was a lot of backlash, as we all saw.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that was a little bit unfair. It was a little bit warranted, but mm-hmm. it was a little bit unfair. And I think that protecting a piece of software that's pretty key to how a product works and something that's really ahead of its competitors allows you to be able to grow in certain ways that sometimes you can't
mm-hmm.
If you don't have that. So it's complicated, and it's funny. I feel this like weird feeling because I want things to be open source, and I think like models like Nathan you know, that Nathan has developed with SparkFund is incredibly amazing to me. It's like one of my favorite business models, that they just go so fast that no one can catch up with them. But in my opinion, it's really hard to build consumer products. It's really hard to build mass market products in that way, at least right now. That's changing, but I think right now and for the next couple of years or decades or so, it's going to be true.
So right now, open hardware makes maybe more sense for niche products or very electronic or engineering-oriented products and less for main mass markets.
You're never going to see SparkFund sell into Best Buy. And you will see, I think last week, 3 Systems started selling their cube printer in Staples, which is very interesting, sort of entertaining, but very interesting. And that would never happen. They're not open source, but, you know, it's very similar to the MakerBot. So you can sort of say, MakerBot could be in Best Buy. And that's very, very different kind of business. Even though they feel almost very similar, like people that buy MakerBots often are buying stuff at SparkFund. But the kind of product that they're selling is actually very different than the kind of product. The kind of product MakerBot sells is very different than the kind of product that SparkFund sells. And so they definitely, SparkFund caters to, short-run production, very niche products. They're very highly technical. A lot of their value is in speed and intellectual what documentations and specifications that are really hard to get other ways. And those kinds of things are not nearly as valuable for something like MakerBot.
Yeah, thank you. It's interesting. So what's the last question? What's the next step for Bolt? You're going to, look at all these applications and when do the companies going to have their answers and how many people are going to come? What's the next step?
Yeah, so I would almost say that that's the first step. So even though that, raising money and building out an office space and all these things are really hard and really important to do, they are, they're not really what drives me. What drives me is making great products. And so the first step is to pick these companies, and we have many, many hundreds of these to read through and pick.
How many exactly? It's not done.
I actually don't know.
You don't know?
I haven't had the time to go through the applications as much as I wanted to, and it's constantly changing. It's constantly getting bigger. So it's less than 1,000.
That's awesome.
More than several hundred, at least last I checked. And it's awesome. I also have to read them all. And we want to give everybody a bunch of attention. And I think that even if a company may not be a great fit for Bolt, we try to help as much as we can with companies, all over the world. And I try to do these office hours when I'm in the city to, say, hey, listen, I've built a lot of products and my team has built way more products, and we can help with anything from prototyping to design to manufacturing to financing to getting into retail. And having those pieces available, I think, is an important thing for us.
And you're based in Boston, right?
Yes, we are based in downtown Boston.
All right. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for answering all these questions and giving so many good advice. And hopefully it's going to be online very soon and getting some good feedback from the readers.
Awesome. Well, I'm excited to be here for the first one, so thanks for having me.
Awesome.
All right. Thanks for listening and see you soon for a new episode. And before that, you can check online on makingsociety.com all the resources we talked about in this interview. Bye.